The Bezdin will sell him as an eretz. Okay? So, that's one way. The other way is he can sell himself into slavery. He can sell himself into slavery. And that's because of the poverty. The person's in a state of poverty. He can't make a living. So, he has a right to sell himself into slavery. Now, our Parsha is talking about the one who Bezdin sold because of his neighbor. That's an important point. Although, with regard to most issues, it'll be the same result. The result in slavery is the same. The rules are pretty much the same, the way he has to treat him and so forth. Nevertheless, there are some differences, and maybe we'll focus on one of those differences today. Okay? So there's the term. Bezdin can only sell him for a term of 6 years, and on the 7th year he goes free. In Begapo Yevo, Begapo Yete. If he came in alone, he goes out alone. There's a passage that, what do you mean? He came in alone, he goes out alone. As opposed to what? What are we talking about? So Rashi says, in the Gabal Yavo, Shalhoya Nasui Isha. It means that he was unmarried. Alright? If he comes in to the situation without a wife, then he leaves alone. Now what does it mean he leaves alone? What do you mean? He can't get married during the interim? What does that mean? What's the shot? What's it mean, Begapo Yetze? So why would that be Begapo Yetze? Is that what it means? He can't marry
also. He doesn't marry somebody who goes
alone? It means Begapo Yetze, Magid, that comes, I'm sorry?
He doesn't marry somebody
who goes alone? Well, how do you go alone?
What?
You mean you're talking about if you gave him a shifra?
Well, he's the master. Yeah. It's a world, though. I mean,
the death of Yosef. Magid she'im lo hoyinah. So he comes to tell me that if he wasn't married, in Kriwa, ain't have a most low shifra k'nan. Behold, the men of others. That tells me that if he was right, it's true. So Begapo Yavo, Begapo Yete, which means true. That if that happens to be the halacha, that the master has the right to give Meshikha Kananas in order to have their children, and those children become the property of the master, so to speak, because they are avadim. They're not Jews. They're the children of Shifchos. Okay? So their status will be the status of an Eved, and they belong to the master. Alright? Now, in Baal Ishahu, if however he is married, the Yotza Ishto Imo, then his wife goes out with him. See, here's where the puzzle becomes a little bit complicated. Because what do you mean his wife goes out with him? Which wife are we talking about? We're not talking about the one that he had as a an eved, is it?
Another one.
Yeah, so it's switching the brand now. So now we're talking about Fubu Kampu. Now we're talking about the one, his own wife. And it says that his wife goes out with him. So of course the question is, what do you mean she goes out with him? When did she become a slave in the first place? Alright. So Rashi explains, Pinching had to sort of use certain terms to refer to something else. So Rashi says, if Nisa, who brought her in, she takes it. I mean, the whole thing doesn't make sense. I have a Magad HaKasav, but the Pasuk teaches me, Shakona Eved Ivri, as one who purchases an Eved Ivri, Chayav Mizono Zishto Uvono. Means that she goes out with him, means, in a sense, she does go out. She goes out from a privilege that she partook of. That one of the obligations of the master to the Eved is that he has to take care of his wife. He has to depart because that's the obligation of a husband. He has to support his wife. But now he himself is not free. He became an Eved. So he can't support her. So part of the obligations of the master is to support. He takes over the support. He has to support the wife. So the yasa ishta ima means that he no longer has the obligation of supporting her. She goes out with him. Of course, you can ask a question on that too. I mean, what's the hava mean? Why would I think differently? If the whole idea, if the whole obligation stems from the fact that I am, you know, that's one of my responsibilities that I'm to the Eved, I have to take care of his wife, so it would make sense that only when he's my Eved, why should I incur any responsibility to her forever? But alright, nevertheless, that's the focus on. The in my donor of Yitzhak Alicia, if his master shall give him a wife, here we're being introduced to the idea that the master can give him a wife. The Yoda Lovanim Lovanos, and she'll have sons or daughters for him. She'll give birth to him, sons or daughters. But Isha Viladeha, the wife and her children, Tia Ladoneha, shall belong to her master, Vahu Yeshu Vagapo. And he goes out alone. The Pasuk in my daughter, even Isha, wouldn't know that he can only give him a wife if he's already married. Because it doesn't say so in that Pasuk.
I intend it.
In the previous pasuk of Begapo Yel, Begapo Yete, from that I learn out that the halacha of giving a wife is only if he already has one from Yisrael. Okay? So of course this forms one of the questions that we have to address ourselves to. That is to say, we see that in the institution of the livery, for one reason or another, whatever that reason might be, that's a special hatter, by the way. It's a special hatter because ordinarily a shikra, as you know, a shikra kinanis is asar to a Jew. Because the shikra, because the deraisa. And here the Torah has created a special makia. So he can live with her and have children with her. So the primary question is, why? What's the reason for this? Along with that, we have to address ourselves to the point that if that is the case for whatever reason, so why is it only if he already has a wife? It's only if he comes into the situation married. If he comes into the situation unmarried, then we can't. So why should that make a difference? The Manasha, I mean, it's part of the institution, it should be there regardless. Okay? The Amar, so, but now, how Pasuk Dalet is telling us the halacha, that if he does give him a wife, so what's the halacha? The halacha is that the wife and the children remain with the master, and he goes out alone. The Amar Yomar Eved, but if the Eved should say, Hahakti es Adoni, es Ishti es Banai, I love my master, my wife, and my children. Lo Eitze Chavshi, I don't want to go free. The Gisho Adonav El Ho Elohim, he's talking about Bezin, and the master brings him to the Bezin. The Gisho Adela Soha Mezuzah, and they bring him to the doorpost, the Mezuzah. The Rus Adonav El Zazno, Bamatzea, and the master has to pierce his ear with an awl, type of an instrument, that can, you know, piercing instrument. Ba'avad El Yorah, and he assures him, Lo Olam Avim Yim Pul Yovel. And by Yovel he goes free. And Yovel is a 50, well, it depends, it doesn't have to be a 30 or 50 years, it all depends upon where we stand at that moment. Alright, so before we proceed, what would you say are some of the questions that should be raised on this parsha? Parsha that we're looking at. Timeline question, what is the, first of all, what is the desire of the Torah? Was the desire of the Torah that we should work for 50 years in the Torah? So that's the end of that. Why do I care? Why should this be the factor? Ahapti as Ishti, as Adonai, as Bonai, right, the whole thing. Why should that make a difference? I mean, either he has an option to remain in that situation, or he does not. If he does, so why does it require all these factors? Even if it's not because he likes his wife, or if he, you know, he didn't, let's say he took a wife and didn't have the children. Let's say he didn't take a wife, and it's not always the case. The master may not have one, and may not give him one. Okay. And moreover, what else stands out in this project? What else stands out in this Parsha?
Division.
Yeah. Then out of nowhere comes this business, about the tzia. The question, I don't know if Rashi necessarily is asking the same question that we're asking. Rashi is asking a question with regard to the ear, if you, right? You remember, Rashi is trying to explain why the ear of all the organs. We're asking a different question, what's the whole point of piercing? Yeah. What is the point of the piercing? And Rashi doesn't seem to be bothered by that. Rashi seems to accept that, but Rashi says, why of all the organs would the Torah achieve the ear? And then he has these negations, right? That the ear which heard. So there's a certain significance. We're asking, what is the significance of it? What is the point of it? What's the point of having the ear pierced? Now, even if you go with the answer of Rashi, but the ear which heard on Har Sinai. Basically, Rashi gives two answers. Because this piercing would have to make sense in that you're talking about two different individuals. One is the person who's there because he stole. One is the person who's there because he didn't steal, didn't put it there. He was embodied. Yeah, both of them, however, have to be have their ear pierced. So Rashi is saying, if the ear was chosen because his ear was heard on Har Sinai, what did the ear hear on Har Sinai? He looked at nothing. And this person went and he stopped. So let that ear be pierced. Alright, that's one. Now what about somebody, one second, what about one who is in that situation and he did not steal? Didn't do any avera. So he brings down another medrash. The other drasha is based upon the reason for the delos in Mezuzah. Right, why is it by there? They're Aden. Mikol Kalen Shavayot. Why is it by the doorpost? Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, so God says, delos in Mezuzah, show you Aden in Mitzrayim. That's a different idea. So in other words, the Ritzia has two different ideas. One is the reflecting in the ear, the other one is the location, the delos in the Mezuzah. Because the delos in the Mezuzah gives testimony to an event of Mitzrayim. What is the event of Mitzrayim? She Pasachti, when God, so to speak, skipped over Ala Mashko, the Ashtam Zuzos, the Amarti, and I said, Ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim. So, it's based upon the pasuk that b'nei Yisrael are avadim to me. Avadayhem, below avadim l'avadim. They are servants to me, but not servants to servants. V'halav zeh, this person went, v'kana adam liyatzva. And he acquired a master for himself, he ruts out this man, let him be pierced in front of them. So in other words, now Rashi is accounting for the significance of piercing in both cases. If it's because of stealing, so that's Lotig Novi. It reminds Lotig Novi. If it's not, and you stole yourself, so then it's because the doorpost. The doorpost is a reminder that you're also in violation of that. You're in violation, it's not a mitzvah here. But you're sort of negating the Holy See of Mitzrayim. The Holy See of Mitzrayim was of Kibri Bnei Yisrael Avodim. Avodah Heim, Kolo Avodim Avodim. These are the facts. Okay? Now the calculus raised is very strange. Because if this is to be a certain type of rebuke, it's intended as a certain type of rebuke or a punishment or whatever, to be stole, so then we have a number of problems. Because this will not necessarily happen. It will only happen if he wants to renew his contract, if he wants to be never the other. But if that's the reason, it should have been done immediately. It should have been done immediately. Once you know even further, now that we've gotten to this point, once you know even further, the question would then be, if that's the case, why is it only in this situation? Why is it not in the case where a person steals them? Why is it Lotik Novi? This ear hurt, it didn't hear properly, in other words. It didn't learn when the left, it was Lotik Novi, that's what we're saying, right? So, then this should be the standard punishment for anyone who steals, because the ear left. Why is it only steals, he doesn't have this happen to him. He does not have this happen to him. Okay? Why not? That's one question. If, well, now, for whatever reason, he only occurs if there's a Zogim Magnetic. But if that's the case, then it should be right away. And that should be a vote taker. But the piercing should occur right away. Because if it's for the sin of Lotik Nova, it should be right away. If it's for the selling himself into poverty, should he bring himself above him? So again, it should be right away. Then why is he only if he decides to stay on? And he's only staying on because of a hot case this year, so Tony, that's why he's staying on. He's not staying on because of anymore because of the original situation. There's another question now. So, well, there's two questions we ask. First of all, he asked a question on both reasons. That, of course, the ear heard both ignobles. But, again, so anytime a person doesn't have ears, you know, they appear. They're not ears. It's the ear heard. Whatever it is, I mean, that you shouldn't be trade, but you shouldn't violate neither. You shouldn't mahal Shabbos, whatever. Why is it only, why is the ear more liable for violating this command than the other command? And with regard, however, with regard to the other one, with regard to the Kibbutz Mansal Avadim, what would you ask on that? That's an even harder one to understand. Yeah? In other words, the kasha is that where is there a contradiction? Where do we see that the state of being an Eved Ivri prevents a person from doing mitzvah? From being an Eved Hashem? It doesn't seem that it's not that obvious. Because, first of all, the Gemara explains that the Ma'asah has to treat him with tremendous dignity and provide all his needs. In fact, Chazal say that if he acquires an Eved, it's like he acquires an Ma'asah. Why? Because he can't mistreat him. He can't keep him on a lower lifestyle than he's than he has. That's why if he only has one pillow, he has to give it to the other. Because if he uses it, then he's sleeping on a pillow and the other's sleeping on the floor, so then he's subjugating the other. Right? So he has no choice, he has to give it to the other. That's what they say, whoever is Kona, whatever is Kona, other Meyaka. That's how the Tzaddik wants a great land to make it very, very gentle. He shouldn't abuse him in any way. But certainly he does the mitzvah. The only halachic change is with regard to the heter of a shifta. That's not a violation. So why, what is the meaning of this? What do you mean, avodai hain v'lo avodim avodim? It's not the same thing. It's not as though he's giving up God, he's taking out a new master, he's serving God. Essentially it's economic, he's working for the God. That's another monoshop type of question. The Torah seems to have two attitudes about this whole institution. On the one hand, it, first of all, in certain cases, doesn't even supposed to tell him. In other cases, the Torah, where he is in poverty, is permitted. Some of the I mean, either the thing is bad or it's not bad. If the Torah is giving him permission to do it, so why is it then sort of punishing him for doing it? The Torah should prohibit the thing entirely. You know what I mean? It's like an ambivalent thing. If the thing is really bad, exactly. So I was saying, it's about avodah hain. This can be very tall about it. That means that you shouldn't have we don't know how it works but yet, that he's really losing that, but look at him here. So then the Torah should have said no, and you can't say it's not. Because kinibre is not strong enough to prevent us from having the institution. But it is strong enough to force us to, pierce the guy's ear. I mean, how does that work? Also, it's interesting that there must be a connection between the two different causes that we have. There are two factors which can bring a guy into the state of slavery, of evidence, Geneva, or being in poverty. Right? And there's Mitzia for both. Of course, each one has its own particular significance, but are these two unrelated, two completely unrelated things? The mice of Mitzia is for both. The question is the two completely unrelated defects? One is a Lotik Nova and one is a Avodah Hain, or is there a relationship between the two? That's another issue. Yeah. Firstly, as Jeff points out, a Pasuk in this letter, a Perek Yud, a Pasuk Dalet, Rosh Osa Kaplanina. The poor man uses the beautiful hand. Poverty is connected to the practice of deceit. there's a connection between the two.
Okay.
To focus on the question of the halacha that is allowed to give a neshecha. Because that really, all the other things, you know, we can understand. All right, there was here, we have a question there, okay, technicality, about it. It's not that outlandish. It doesn't stand out that terribly. And why it took after 6 years, why not? At the beginning, I mean, these things can be worked out. But what strikes us as being totally strange is this idea of the shivcha. Where does that come into the picture? I can't really understand. We're talking about somebody who stole. He stole money. Somebody who committed a crime. So basically, the obligation is to pay back. There's no real punishment to stealing. There's no punishment to be like stealing. Simply that if the money steals, he enjoys the chiyuv of returning the money. So he can't make restitution. So now, Bezdin is going to put him in a situation of others, where he's going to lose a certain amount of freedom in order to make restitution. That's it. Okay? All these things make sense. Then you see that it's a very humane institution. You see it's a very humane institution. That there's no denigration of the person. We don't want to harm the person in any way. Right? You know, because it can't be done in a humiliating fashion. It doesn't harm him. And, in fact, the master has to take good care of him, and he has to take care of the Torah points out of his wife. Because he shouldn't suffer as a result of this. That's very compassionate. But then out of nowhere, this whole concept of the shivcha comes into the picture. What's the point of it? Why? The Torah makes a point that the master can give him a shivcha. And tells us that the Isha Vivodah Tiyaladanah. Now why is the Torah remove something which normally would be offered? What's the point? What's the reason behind that? And in trying to understand that, we have to take into consideration some of the technical factors that are involved. One is on the condition that he already has a wife. If he doesn't have a wife, it can't be done. Okay? The second important idea to bear in mind, this is vital, because without this idea, you'll never figure it out. This is a vital fact. This is what when I finally discussed it with me, first I gave him a practical kind of answer. But when I thought about this fact, it made it easier. Without this fact, you can't come up with a legitimate answer. That this halacha that he's been given a shifa is only if he was sold by Bezin for the neighbor. But Mokhar Atzal cannot be seen. No. That's how it's put down in Rambam. Rambam in Hilchos Avodim, which is in Kenyan, state of Kenyan. Terek Gimel, Halacha Yedbeg. Ma bein mocher atzmo l'machru bezin. What's the difference between one who sold himself or someone who was sold by bezin? Mocher atzmo eino nirta. Mocher atzmo is not nirta. L'machru bezin nirta. L'machru bezin is nirta. This seems to be against Rashi. Okay? This seems to be not wrong, because Rashi said that if he sold himself, he is the answer, and that's the budget that was removed. Right, so it could be that there's different yeshitas, is that what I'm talking about? Okay. Mocher atzmo, usher b'shipa t'nas. One who sold himself is usher in a shipa t'nas. The Mokhru Bezdin, Rabba Moser lo shipa t'nas. The master gives him a shifa knas. Okay? So clearly you see the halacha psuka, right? That apparently, in purely halacha terms, you would say, that the matya for a shifa is not in the chalosh of the river. But in terms of chalosh and the river, they both have the same. Right? Whatever. The point is, whatever it is, the master does not have a right to, I'm not trying to define halacha right now, I'm trying to understand it philosophically. Our question is, what is the reason behind this halacha? That the master can give a shikra to the person of having children. What's the reason for it? And in understanding that, we must take into consideration that it's only if he already has a wife. And secondarily, that it only is one category of eretz, that is the category who became an eretz because God told him to gnei. But if he became an eretz because he told himself out of poverty, then it cannot be done. And that seems to be really a question, because that's part of the solution. It should be there in most cases. So you have to modify your thinking upon it. Obviously, it's not simply a part of the institution. Of the two questions, the easier question, it seems to me, would be the one as to why you must already have a wife. That would be easier to answer. But why, that I answer first. That's the question I find interesting. I answered that right away. The question as to why it's only possible to give him a shifter if he already has one. That's fitting into the general flow. And let me tell you, the answer to that we would say is what? Pushing.
No? Well, he's got to relate to, you know, marriage and, you know.
In other words, like this, it fits in with the general idea that even though the Torah did create the institution, it's negative. The Torah views it as being negative. So that we do have certain cases where it's ambivalent. Where the Torah saw fit, for whatever reason, has to allow something. But even though it views it as being negative. So it's sort of a compromise. Evidently, it's obviously a compromise situation where it's there because sometimes you have no choice and it has to utilize. But it's set it up in such a way to discourage the person. And if he has to become an evidence, then he should do the fit of office. It's only a temporary testament of measure. It's a therapeutic kind of measure. Sort of like akin, perhaps, the way the Rabbin formulates notice. But not the same. Not the same thing. But still, it evidently is a negative kind of a thing. So therefore, the Torah, the question we're dealing with is why he really has to have a wife. The Torah did not want to do anything which would cause him to become more entrenched in the situation. And the Torah wanted him to utilize the time, pay off his debt, whatever it is, and then leave. The Torah wants him to be a free person. It doesn't want to be an Ivan. It's a temporary measure. So therefore, it was, if he didn't have a wife, and gave the shifcha, said that's going to increase the possibility of entrenchment. He gives him more of a trust to her, that's going to be his wife. But if he already has a wife, so he's already got a tie on the outside world, that's his wife, that's his home, that's his family. He has a family, so he wants to give back to his family. And now, even though you're giving him a shifcha, the chances are much less than, assuming all things, of course, being equal, the chance is going to be much less, so he's going to be yours, he's going to get the shifcha. So now he's doing it because he's doing it for the sake of the mess and so on and so forth. So that's why, but the Torah didn't want to take a chance on allowing this for a person that has no wife. Because if he has no wife, so this becomes his wife, so this is where his attachment will be. And then he won't want to leave. That's the way I answer the question. But as we were talking, I said, yeah, but then someone's going to ask, if that is the case, and the Torah does have a concern, and this can lead to it, I said, because with all of this, the next pasuk is a obvious issue. Right. That's talking about the guy
who has a wife already.
So you see that the Torah did leave open the door, the avenue, for that possibility. So then what's the whole purpose of the institution altogether then? Why do it? I mean, I was explaining the other thing. That my basic question, the Mamad of Shach, it doesn't really knock off the whole thing. I mean, the answer is, yeah, the life works that way. There are certain institutions that you have to have, but they're negative, but you have no choice. The alternative is worse. So the Torah establishes even the kingship, you see, like that. Some says, well, like a melech. The whole, it's not logic, whether it's a chiyuv, whether it's a reshus, but then it hedges the malchus with a lot of restrictions. Because there's, on the one hand, it's essential. You have to have government. You have to have a king. On the other hand, it's dangerous. Because if it's corrupt, so it could destroy the whole society. So what do you do? You have to have kingship, but then you establish it in such a way to do the best you can to prevent the corruption. This is again not identical, because here's a negative thing by nature. Everything is negative by nature. It's not essential by nature. It's negative. But you can have in this situation, the person has fallen into this level and he needs it. So, but the Torah is doing it in such a way that it should be temporary. That answers my question, Rosh Hashanah question. But here it seems to be in contradiction with that principle. Because now you're getting, now you're bringing in a whole new thing, which is making it much more complicated. You're bringing in the shikha. And the shikha is going to make it permanent. So therefore, that's why I'm explaining that it could only be if he already has a wife. Because then it won't become permanent.
Yeah.
But you see, that could be the factor which does make it permanent. And it even makes it harder for us to understand what's the reason behind it altogether. Just, the thing was up to begin with. In order to allow this, the Torah had to remove an issue, which is the major issue. It's not an insignificant issue. So why is the Torah going to see when the Torah is going out of its way over here to remove an issue to enable him to give him a shifra? When we don't understand why it's there, and we see from the way it's been set up that you have to take precautions that it shouldn't be a factor which makes it permanent. Why? Just stand out the sore thumb. At first I wanted to say, simply, and it was in the framework of a practical answer. You have to give an answer. Sometimes you have to give an answer. To give a practical, it's an explanation. It's not the greatest answer, but it gives some reason. And my first explanation was that, look, you have to consider the Torah to take all that has to be just in all its ways. So the justice over here cannot only be one way. I mean, you see the Torah is doing a lot for the sake of the other. And then there's a lot of obligation to the other. He has to take care of them and provide for his wife. So then there should be some benefit in it for him as well. And therefore, it's part of the service. That he's compensated for it by, in addition to the work, he can't make him work too hard, and if you work, he provides children for him from the ship. That's a practical kind of answer. And it didn't satisfy me. I mean, I thought about it afterwards. I don't want to, why did you like it?
No, one out of the case.
Then one out of the case, exactly, of Maharaj. Well, if you can tell me that, that's what bothers me the most. If you can say that, let's assume, because sometimes the Rambam and the Torah will give some practical types of answers. But you have to understand that once you have a system, there's an institution, you have to have practical incentives, otherwise it won't work. So an answer can be, some of the things that are can be explained in relation to practicality. But if that's the case, then why should it be the same thing by Rocker Aspel and you see it's not? So that eliminated the factor. And also it bothered me that it doesn't explain just because of the needs of the master, but what about the system of the Torah? The Torah didn't want a Jew to control it with a shifra. So why are you removing the issue? You're doing something even further, you're removing an issue over here. But just because of that, it just didn't seem that strong. So I went back to the drawing board, but this time I focused on the fact. The most decisive fact was that it was only in a case where it's because of the gate. And I worked out an answer that I'd like to present, but I'll use it. It's not halacha in the state of being there. It's part of the onus for the avera of the neighbor. And the onus is to really cure the guy. I thought of it in terms of the Rambam, that the refuah, very often for a bad disposition or character trait, is, roughly speaking, going to the other extreme. You have to subject an individual to the other extreme. Now here, what is the sin of your neighbor? It's a negation of the right to the other person. You know, it's just a guy. Things are coming against him. He can't relate to the objective, the value of somebody else's needs, somebody else's rights. He negates it. It has no value, it has no reality for him. Because he's totally focused on his own self, his own selfishness. Now, the cure for that is that the entire purpose, in my opinion, of giving him the shukra is because Ha'isha bilateh tzil abinah. Because here, the person forms an emotional attachment, and he naturally will regard it as his own. Now, luckily, it's not his own. So here, he's forced. In other words, he negated another person's objective right, because you have to relate to another person's rights in terms of it's an abstract concept, right? Because he was totally involved in his own emotional attachment. Here he goes to the other extreme. He has to affirm that we live in a system that's based upon objective ideas. He has to affirm the objective right of the other person where it goes against his own emotion. It's the exact opposite. You're curing the disease of the doctor. You see what I'm saying? In other words, he's detaching himself from a detachment to his own ego as being the only reality. And he's doing so by affirming the rights of another individual. But these are rights that you can only relate to in terms of the objective. And on the emotional level, it's even mine. My wife, my kids. Biologically, a person will naturally have a feeling that they're his. But now, you can't live by your biological. You have to live by objective, by the objective, by the extract. In terms of the extract, they're not yours, they belong to him. Now, he does that, so that is raising himself to a higher level. He now recognizes that everything how do you determine is what belongs to him, what doesn't, it's all based upon, he has to subscribe to an objective system of ideas which determines what rights, what your rights are, what the other person's rights are, and he has to yield his own, for the sake of somebody else's. That's the cure. Because in his sin, he negated the other person for the sake of his own instinctual desire. And here he's negating his instinctual desires for the sake of the other person's objective rights. So that's why it only applies in the case where he sold because of his neighbor. See? That answers the question. It's not halacha and halacha and yadidivri. It's rather halacha that as part of the mechira, the key of the mechira is to cure the individual. Motignova. That's part of the problem. Motignova. This is part of the cure. However, it doesn't apply in the case where he didn't have a wife, because it affects another factor. I mean, you see, that's not a problem on this anymore. That wouldn't be a question, if that's the case. Because, you see, this particular cure has to fit into the overall institution of evidentiary. It can't negate the institution. And it's not an inherent obligation of the institution. The basic punishment is to render them into an evidentiary, the institution. And that institution does carry the permit for him to give him a shifcha. But that's not an obligation, because let's say he doesn't have a shifcha. Or let's say he doesn't want to give him a shifcha, whatever the case may be. You see? But the Torah did provide for that possibility. Now, my other answer, it could be, it's only where it's beneficial to the master. So it fits in on both levels. Because the Torah didn't want the master to benefit. But that alone would suffice. You see? But if the master wants the benefit, because it says, it is part of it. You see, by the way, Chazal mentioned that he's working for him by day and by night. And everybody works for him by day and by night. By day, he does the work, and by night, he produces children. So this is regarded as something he's doing for the master. See? But this type of work, well, that's the whole idea. In other words, by having to work for somebody else, the whole concept of evidently, that is the cure. That is to say, that here, he's giving up the work of his hands, which he naturally feels entitled to, and he has to relinquish it because I have to live in accordance with the rights that completeness belongs to the master. So he's building up within himself that recognition of the rights of somebody else. See? But this is an extension of that idea. So it's no shaila, it's no question anymore if he doesn't have a wife, because that would upset the whole institution. We don't want him to stay forever. That's worse. But if he already has a wife, and we're not concerned that he's going to become overly attached, so then the question is, what's the point? Why the Torah really isn't? The answer is for the sake of, it did remove something which would normally be us. It was my answer, because the overall perfection of the God was much more involved in overcoming the defects of the neighbor in this particular. What I would say is, and even the answer to the case of the Ritzia would be a extraordinary formulation. I would say that the person is given an opportunity to rectify the situation. The neighbor that's going to have to step, right? Wherein the person is committing an error. It's true that philosophically it involves the negation of the other person's rights, but it's an act of injustice.
But the primary way of addressing it is through the tumor. The tumor would be through the justice, through compensation. The person recognizes that he's coming along, he makes compensation, and of course he asks the tumor, and that suffices. I assume that he recognized his case, but not just recognition. He was able to perform the act of justice, which is essential to cure him of that, to earn the money and pay it back. Maybe there's a penalty, maybe there's not, whatever the case may be. So that's it. He's cured himself. He can't get his own needs no further than that. Here we're talking about someone that committed that error and he can't do the act which would cleanse him, which would purify him. So that now we have to do something. You can't leave him in that state. So then we have to put him into a situation for which is designed to cure him of that defect. So David Bacon is very good. Does that understand? Then why is what I'm saying? What we're saying is like this. That we're bothered by the problem, so by the problem, if that's the case, then it's really beneficial, then what should he get if he already has what? And I say that just because the Torah is concerned on the other end, then it shouldn't become a test. Now, along with that, Jeff points out that given that is the philosophy of the Torah, that we're going by the universal. The universal situation is that one who already has a wife will not become that attached to this wife and the children, because he will view them in a totally different light. So therefore, it won't produce that benefit either. The leaving of that wife will not be a benefit of them. In other words, it follows, therefore, that the attachment to this wife and to these children will not be the same, because he won't regard them as his children, because he already has a wife, yeah, and children whom he does properly regard as his children. So, correspondingly, both ideas go hand in hand. A, we don't want him to become attached. You see? We don't want to take the chance of him becoming attached. And B, universally speaking, we don't define him as being an onesh because since he's very attached to the other wife and children, he doesn't have the same regard for them. So it doesn't have the same effect. So it works on both levels. It works on both levels. If the Torah was not there something, which is an irrelevant matter, we just think of protecting him in the written realm of Mishpat. It was a hospital. For many people, the idea of eating any dead machmir like anything when it comes to alcohol for food or any kind of thing is a quite question. But they don't apply the same degree of severity when it comes to business practice. It's in his mind. You have to tell a different picture. The A is A from this, the opposite idea that the Torah was lenient, with a very serious system. It was mafia, of course it's a mafia. But nevertheless, the Torah uprooted something in the realm of the Israelite in terms of the Syrian idea for the sake of perception with regard to an area of Geneva, which there's a monarchy over there, some relation there. Let's try and find those issues about the matter that you already have one. On any level, if he takes this ship, he can be attached to her, and he certainly will be attached to the children, that's for sure. Now, that is sufficient. Whether he has a wife, even if he already has a wife, he will form an attachment. And he certainly will form an attachment to the children. Because you see that a person can be attached to children by a lot, even if he doesn't like the wife. That's a separate attachment to the children. So that is the ego, the right to give them up. Okay? And the benefits of giving them up, the attachment will be strong enough that there will be the benefit of giving them up. The renunciation of his own tie. So he has his own tie, his own ego. Okay? However, we're not concerned that due to the fact that he already has a wife, we are not concerned that the attachment will be so powerful that he won't be able to leave the situation. So we want him to be in a state where he has sufficient desire to leave the situation. And in doing so, he's overcoming his tie to the children, he's giving up his rights. That's exactly the state that we're looking for. See? It's not that we're saying that here there's no tie, it's going to be easy. Because you're right, then there's no benefit for it. What's the benefit of it? Okay? So, we don't want to stack the debt. If he didn't have any children, then we're afraid they don't want to stay. So maybe they don't achieve the purpose. A, I want to stay in the institution, right? And B, there was no benefit because he doesn't need to give up the children. So he don't get the benefit. Where's the cure? You see? So in that situation where he didn't have any children, as we said, first of all, we don't want him to stay in the situation. And B, if he stays in the situation, he doesn't get the benefit. because he retained the children. He still with the children. They're still his. He didn't give them up. He's always been with them.
Okay.
So what we want to do is to get into the situation. But we want an additional benefit that in leaving the situation, he's overcoming a certain amount of pain. Of giving up something which he would rightfully or emotionally would regard as not. And that is the perfect, don't look at the perfect balance. That is to say, you put him in order of quantity. He's already got his wife and his family wants to go in there. But to do so, he's got to leave these kids behind. He's got to break away from him. When he's in the situation, he's leaving his kids behind. That's beneficial to him. It's almost like a soldier, and, you know, he goes overseas. But he has a child over there. Well, he has a child over there, because, you know, he's always been in soldiers, they don't want to play anyone. Or a child over there. But it's not any blood of sin. I probably want to come out. We can't bring the child back with him. Right? Oh. So the child itself is not enough to keep you there. But nevertheless, he's going to have suffering. He's going to have a bother. He's going to have the issue about it. And a lot of bother. The thing he has laid is going to kill people, except for now, whatever. Because he didn't give an obligation. So that's exactly what we're looking for over here. The man basically the guy wants to go home. But we want him to experience that renunciation.
With regard to the meeting of Moshe and Israel, you know the story that he saved the daughters from the shepherds and so forth. Then they come home early and he rebukes them because they abandoned Moshe. They tell Yisrael what we had saved them, and so he says, where is he? He ready? Akar Satel to invite him for meal. So they invite Moshe in. Then it says that Moshe agreed to stay L'Shemes HaSeish. He decided to stay with him. And then it says that he gave Tzipporah Bito to Moshe. He gave his daughter Tzipporah as a wife to Moshe. There's a very interesting medrash Rashi brings down on the word by Yoel. What does Rashi say? By Yoel? Kimashmo, plain shot. But there's another shot. And what is that? It's an expression of Allah, Medrash Olosh and Allah. By Yoel is related to the word Allah, which is an oath. Nishbalo Shlo Yozuz Minilya. He swore to him that he wouldn't move from Midian to Imbershuzo without his permission. Okay? That's a very, very interesting idea. It's a strange kind of a thing. It seems like it's coming out of nowhere. It's one thing to agree to live with a person. Right? And then he married his daughter. But what's the basis for such a shvuah? Where do we find such a concept that that a person would impose this, has a right to impose this on a son-in-law? Sure, that we don't leave Midian except with his permission. What was the word basis for? Even before the marriage. So that makes it even more difficult to understand. Okay. Now let's turn to the, a little bit further. After the encounter at the Sneh, according to Chazal, it was 7 days, the whole dialogue between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Moshe, and finally Moshe has no choice, he has to accept the mission. So what does he do? He has to go back to Yisrael to inform him that he's going back to Mitzrayim. Let's take a look at the way the Torah sees fit to point out how Moshe justified it to Yisrael. Perek Dalet, Pasuk Yud Ches. So it says, Vayelech Moshe. This is after the conclusion of the encounter at the Sneh. And Moshe went, Vayoshev el Yeser Chosno, and he returned to his father, Mo Yisro. Vayomolo, and he said to him, Elchon na, Nazaloshna Bakasha. Please go. Vyashuva el Achai Asher Mitzrayim. And I will return to my brethren who are in Mitzrayim. The era how dumb chayim, and I'll see if they're still alive. Vayomer Yisro l'Moshe, and Yisro said to Moshe, Leich l'shalom,
go two feet. That's an interesting thing in its own right. I'm not going to get into that. What is lech bishalom as opposed to lech lishalom? All right, that's not the point. What's difficult about the pasuk? What is difficult about the pasuk? Vayashem Eliezer Chosno. The reason why he went back to him. So Rashi is lishitasa over here. Rashi says nitol rishus to receive permission. Sharei nishbalo because he had sworn to him shol yozes b'midyan kiim rishuso. In accordance with the same medrash, so it makes sense that he had sworn that he wouldn't leave without his rishus. That's why he went back. Okay, so we understand that, but there's still something that's problematical. Well, if you take it literally, I mean, he knew that they were alive, and if you, I don't know that, I don't think it means that literally to see whether physically there's still any of them left. I think it means, in a sense. So if they're alive, there's still a people there. I mean, I don't think he meant like a genocidal type of thing. To see whether there was genocide and there's not one Jew left, I don't think he meant it in that sense. So therefore, I don't think he could be accused of lying in that way. As though I don't know if they're still alive. But the problem is, if there is an Allah, which we don't understand why there is, but we assume that there's a resistance, that Yisrael really has a resistance against letting him go out of Midian. And Moshe does need to come up with a decent reason. So this seems to be like the weakest, the lamest of all reasons. What kind of a thing is this? Lerosa Odom Chaim. First of all, if we just look at it in his own right, it seems to be very weak. It doesn't seem to be a real justification. But the more pertinent question is, if you have no choice, sometimes you just have no choice. You don't have a really good excuse. I mean, when you go in court or whatever, you have to defend yourself for a ticket, whatever the case may be. So you try and give the best possible excuse. But sometimes, you know, you're limited. Because, you know, you have to bring proof. You only have a certain... You're limited. And you come up with a weak, a lame excuse. It's a lame excuse. The judge is a lame excuse. But it's very lame. Lame was the only one I've got, you know. That's something else. But here he had a terrific explanation. What better, why did he need to say something like this? The most perfect justification. I'm going because God told me I have to go. Wouldn't that be infinitely better? There, it's not even me. I'm not even, what am I supposed to do? Right? And that's something that Yisrael would relate to. I don't think that there's a problem over there that Yisrael didn't. Yisrael believed in God. Yisrael was a high level individual. He was put in the cherem by the people of the place, at Yisrael, because he had given up idolatry. And we know that later on it says Ati Yodati. Now I know the Gadol Ad Hashem, that God is greater than all the gods. And Rashi teaches us that every had researched through every Avodah Zarah and had rejected them, right, until he came to the. Well, that's not the Adati, that's true. But at this phase, at this point in time, he wasn't at the altar. So, why didn't he tell him? And whether Yisro accepted his God or didn't accept his God, that is a very, very compelling reason. I have to go. My God has told me that I have a mission to perform. I'm doing it personally. Personally, I didn't want to go. Why not tell him the truth? That would make the most sense. To tell the truth. As opposed to that, he does not tell him the truth, and he winds up giving him kind of a very lame kind of excuse, very weak. Seems to me, I'll go back, see if they're still okay. I think that's what Hodav Chaim means, I'll see their condition. To point out, if for some reason, it wasn't supposed to be known, it was supposed to be a secret, that's not the case. Because you see, Moshe went back to Mitzrayim and it was public knowledge. He told everybody. He told the Jews, he told Paro, he told everybody. And what?
Paro thought it was not.
Right. But it didn't stop Moshe. It didn't stop Moshe from telling him. The point of it is, I tend to doubt that, because from subsequent events we see that Yisro was a high level individual. We know that he had different names. He was a very high level individual, and he had tremendous respect for Moshe Rabbeinu. That's clearly obvious. I mean, as soon as he heard about what Moshe had done, he rebuked the daughters, bring them in, and he wanted them to live with him, and he wanted to be with us. How many people, it seems that Moshe Rabbeinu was completely alone. Gera Yisi, I gave a share in that, Gera Yisi Beretz Nachria. I gave that share, it's plumbing. That Gershom, he named his child after the fact that he was a Ger. That he basically was completely alone in that area. He had nobody. There was no one that he could relate to. Except for Yisro. He formed a relationship with Yisro. I mean, knowing what we do about Moshe, the level he was on, and the fact that he'd have a kesha with someone like, I think Yisro would respect him. I think Yisro would respect him, and you could argue that way, but it's to me, it's not that compelling. It's not that compelling. I mean, we see he was going to go back to the Jews and tell them that. And I don't think that Yisro would have thought that he was crazy. Whether Yisro would have accepted or believed or whatever, I think it would have been sufficient to say, if you're convinced that that's the case, then I think you should go. I mean, I don't see why that is hard for us to accept. I mean, if you want to say that, you could say that, but I think if we have a better answer from the text itself, you know, we should go for that. Let's turn to Parshas Yisro. In Yisro we find, this is after Yetzias Mitzrayim. We now move forward after Yetzias Mitzrayim. All these miracles that occurred, and especially Kriyas Yamsuf and so on and so forth. So then it says, Vayishma Yisro, Kohen Midyan, Kosei Moshe. That the Yisro, the Kohen Midyan, the father of Moshe heard, Eis Kosher Asta Elokim Lamoshe, Kul Yisrael, everything that God had done for Moshe and Israel, his nation, Ki Hotzi Et Hashem Es Yisrael Mitzrayim. That emphasizes that separately. Could be a little redundant, right? There's an emphasis that God had taken the Jews out of Mitzrayim. Take a look at Rashi. Rashi explains the various references. It's called Sherasa. See, the pasuk is talking about everything that God had done. Lahem, we read this Haman, the Man, the Be'er, and Amalek. Okay? In other words, he heard about all, not just Yetzias Mitzrayim, but he heard all the miracles. Ki Hotzi Hashem Zu Gedol Al Kulam. And so the Pasuk, according to the Medrash, the reason why the Pasuk emphasizes the fact he heard everything, all the miracles, and that he took the Jews out of Egypt. Zu Gedol Al Kulam. This was the biggest thing of all, that he took them out of Mitzrayim. Okay? Then it says that Yisro Chosei Moshe took Tzipora and the two sons, Gershom and Kiamar, Ger Yisbir Sakriya, and the second one, Eliezer. And then Yisro comes to Moshe with the wife and children to the Midbar, opposite Tihar Alekim, by Har Sinai. And then word is given to Moshe that, he sends word to Moshe that, I, your father and Yisro, have come to you with your wife and children. So Moshe goes out Likras Chosno. Moshe gives him tremendous kavod, as we know. Showed tremendous kavod to his father-in-law. He bows down to him, and he kisses him, and each one inquires of the other, how are you doing? You know, shalom, they give shalom, and they go inside the tent. The pasuk goes out of its way it seems to be expressing a strong friendship, a strong relationship between them. Then Moshe tells him, Sipo Dvarim. He tells him, Eis kol asher asar Hashem l'paro Mitzrayim. Everything that God had done to Paro Mitzrayim, al odos Yisrael, with regard to Yisrael, because of Israel. Eis kol atalah Hashem atzal asam l'derech, and all of the weariness, the travail that they had experienced on the road, on the way. Vayatzilem at Hashem, and that God had saved them. So he told him about all these tremendous things. He told him everything that happened. Yisro was interested. Yisro heard, and he came to inquire. Of course, you know that as a result of this, according to Rashi, he converted. He was a Pesgaya. Because of what Moshe told him. Vayichad Yisro al Kavatova. And Yisro rejoiced because of all the good. Asher. And look at this passage carefully. Asher asar Hashem li Yisrael. All the good he rejoiced for that God had done to Israel. Asher hitzilu miyad Yisrael. And so, of course, wasn't that part of the good? So again, take a look at Rashi. Al kol tova, tova saman daver v'hatora, all the good. V'al kulan asher hitzilu miyad Yisrael. But above everything was the fact that he had saved them. This had a special significance then. Adach shavlo haya eved yochel levroch Mitzrayim. Until now, there was no slave that could escape Mitzrayim. Impossible. Shoy sa'aris besugeres. The land was like a fortress, totally locked up. V'ilu yatsu shishim rigo. And he had hundreds of thousands of God. And let's continue a bit. Vayomer Yisro said, Baruch Hashem, blessed is God, Asher Hitzil Eschem Miyad Mitzrayim, who saved you from the hand of Mitzrayim, and Miyad Paro, from the hand of Paro, Asher Hitzil Eschem Mitachas Yad Mitzrayim, who saved the nation from under the hand of Paro. Atu Yadati Kigadol Hashem Mikol Hoel. Atu Yadati Kigadol Hashem Mikol Elohim Kibadavar Asher Zadu Aleihem. And if you take a look at Rashi, Asher Hitzel Eschem Miyad Mitzrayim Uma Kasha, a powerful nation. Miyad Paro Melech Kasha. Right? Mitachas Yad Mitzrayim. From under the oppression, Ridui, from Maris, Hayu, Shayu Machbid Malayim, Tihu Avoda. Alright. Now, Atu Yadati is very interesting, Rashi here. Atu Yadati, this is important because it reflects back upon the issue of the question, the state of Yisrael at the time that Moshe left. Makiro Hoyisi Lisha'ova. Because the emphasis on Atu, now. Something happened now. I did recognize God, Lisha'ova. And now even more so. So, I believe that in the psukim that we just read, you can work out an answer to the question that we raised. With regard to the nature of the Ola, who imposed it upon who? Yisro imposed it on Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, in my opinion, it's the exact opposite as the way Bruce had it. In other words, it was Yisro was in search of a Rebbe. He was a great individual, and he was put in cherem by the people of the place because he had given up idolatry. So he was a rational individual who went against the religion of the area, and he was searching for the truth. You see, after Ati Adati, he was studying, he was someone who was searching for the truth. And he had no one to teach him. He had no one to learn from. And that's why he was very impressed when he heard about a man like Moshe Rabbeinu. Just a description that they brought back, the type of person, how he practiced chesed, and so forth. So he wanted to meet this person. And once he met this person, he saw that this is a genius, a great, this is what I've been looking for. So that's why, in fact, when he gave his daughter, that's a mitzvah, by the way, to marry if he goes to Talmud Chacham. It's a mitzvah. The mitzvah is right. Was it uvosid bakan? No. Uvosid bakan, to cling to God. Right. Yeah, that's the mitzvah, to cling to. One of the ways in which you to lidavek b'talmid chacham. Lidavek b'talmid chacham is a key in dvekas b'Hashem.
Just kenach
b'Hashem. Yeah, dvekas b'Hashem. So there's different ways. A person should set up all different kinds of situations that he's constantly in touch with Talmid Chacham. Now, one of the ways the Rama mentioned is to marry off your daughter to a Talmid Chacham, so that he'll be at your table, be at your house, and so forth. So that's why he gave his daughter Sitora to Moshe. He wanted to cement the relationship. That's why Rashi by Yoel. I would say by Yoel, you don't have to take it literally, but he sort of implored him to be his, that Moshe should be his rebbe, and not to leave except with his rishus, which means he didn't want to lose Moshe Rabbeinu until he felt confident that he had arrived at a certain level. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu, his objective with regard to Yisro was to bring him to the highest possible level in terms of his relationship to God. And apparently, a key element was by Yishma Yisro. Yisro, because you see, that at the time that he went to Mitzrayim, Yisro was on one level. And afterwards, it says, Makiro, Yisro Mishavah, he changed. His level changed. In fact, he prayed to Baruch Hashem, he blessed God, and he brought Olos Bachem. He brought Karbanos. Right? Now, what's going on over here? What happened? Now here I can't be exact. I can't be that exact, but I would say that Yisro had certain resistances in the area. In other words, it wasn't an emunah shlema. He had certain resistances in the area of his relationship to God. And it focused on the whole issue, I would say, the issue of perhaps God's justice. This issue troubled me. And the question, does God truly rule the world? Or no? You see that there's a human might. A tremendous amount of regard for that's always an obstacle to people believing in God. It's the extent that people don't believe in God because they're overwhelmed by human might. That's the emotions of people waver between the two. The biggest resistance to Amun and Akash Baruch Hu is the Avodah Zarah of human might, Al Tiftach B'Rit Even, the whole field from Rosh Hashanah. Kuntim Melech Elyah, Avon Melech Evyah. Because people put all of their energy, they're overwhelmed by physical forces, physical human might. You know, the human might, that's what really dictates. And as long as they're convinced that what really counts are the human forces, so it's a negation of God. I mean, they pay lip service to God, but there's a negation. And you see that he was completely overwhelmed. Moshe told him the whole story. What overwhelmed him most? The fact that he tears the trap. Apparently, that was a resistance that he had in his mind. It was something that he really couldn't conceive, that it was possible that they could actually escape. If that is the case, then he must have attributed tremendous power to the entity of the tribe. And that's why when Moshe told him all of the Nisim. And he was impressed with all of them, and he rejoiced. But the one which had the greatest impact upon him and resulted in a qualitative change in the Gavra and led to his accepting Yahadus, according to the Rashi's we've mentioned, was Zu Gadol Akula. Was he Tzias Mitzrayim? Right? That broke down an obstacle that existed in the overestimation of human might. He suffered from the overestimation of human might, and it was expressed in the fact that the Mitzrayim had total control. Apparently he was bothered. This bothered him that, right, that there's an injustice is going on, people are being enslaved. That bothers many people. Why does this occur? Why does this happen? That if God does rule the world, and this is completely against God's will, and it's an injustice, and so on and so forth, so why does God allow it to occur? I'm just speculating. I don't know exactly what the exact issues were, but because I'm talking in general terms. Now, I would say, that Moshe Rabbeinu was aware of this. And as a good Rebbe, he knew that in order to perfect Yisro, he had to deal with this issue. But apparently they had come to an obstacle. He couldn't go any further. It's just through logical argumentation. So Moshe Rabbeinu sensed that the event of Yetzias Mitzrayim would have a tremendous impact upon Yisrael. He sensed that. And therefore he used psychology. And what I mean to say is like this, that it has a tremendous impact when it's something which is, yeah, that has to be an element of suspense and totally unexpected. It would have diminished. In other words, had Moshe Rabbeinu told him in advance what God had told him and about the mission and so on and so forth, then it would not have had the same psychological effect. He went there, that's why he had to play down the whole thing. Play down. I'm just going to go down there to see if they're still alive. Nothing, I don't know if I can help, whatever. And let him draw his own conclusions. Let him proceed with his own way of thinking. That there's really, alright, in other words, Yisrael let him go. Yisrael felt that it's very important to Moshe. He's going to come back. It's very important to him. So let him go. And see. Now, in that situation, still having that belief that it was virtually an impossibility that there's any way that the Jews could come out, then when he heard about it, when the Jews came out and he got together with Moshe and he told them all, then it had a tremendous impact. Because when he heard about it, you have to reach a person at the right time. When he received the news, he was in that state where it was just like overwhelming. But once, you see, it's, once you know about an advance already, and you start to think about it, then already it's not going to have the same effect. Then it's different. Then you look back and you'll start to think, well, maybe it wasn't so bad as I thought it was in the first place. Maybe Moshe knew something that I didn't know. Maybe I overestimated the power. Whatever the case may be, if you know, once he already had that information, that Moshe was going down with that purpose in mind, it would not have had the same effect upon him. So what I'm saying is that Moshe deliberately withheld the information, the tzibui, the mission, because he wanted to keep him in that frame of mind. The frame of mind that he was in. Not that he said, I don't know that he openly said it was impossible. He was probably in a very, like, state of, not necessarily confusion, but uncertainty. In a state of uncertainty. In a state of uncertainty where this was an issue, where it troubled him, where it bothered him. And that was the best frame of mind to leave him in with regard to this. And then, Vayish Vayisra. Then when he heard about the great events, then he came out to Moshe. And when Moshe told him what had taken place, then it had maximum impact upon him, intellectually and emotionally. And then, Ati Yadati, Makiro, then he became a changed person. But I am saying that it presupposed that he had no inkling whatsoever of what was going to happen, because once you know already, then he knows he's expecting it, you play. You see, you wouldn't have been in the same emotional state. Then you put it in a different category of the mind. Oh, I knew about that already. It's not going to have the same effect, because the forces of resistance will have an effect upon you.
Then work in.
Yeah, it's got to. You've got to hit a person. It's very important when you're working on a person, and you got to work on the person intellectually, and sometimes you got to hit certain emotions, because there are emotional resistances that are hiding behind certain intellectual resistances. They work together. And timing is an extremely important thing. When a person is ready to receive certain information that will be of benefit to him is extremely important. A good teacher has to know that. And I believe that if he would have told him that l'chatchila, then the amount, so when he heard the news, then it wouldn't have had the effect upon him, because he didn't see it happen. And you see, and then when he found out about it later, it would have been a surprise, because he already had heard about it. It would not have had the same effect upon him. That's why I'm saying that's a matter of speculation. Of course, you can argue with me on that. But what I am suggesting, the answer I'm trying to give, is in line with the fact that we have, which is presented to us in Yisro, and the basic way it's all about all these Rashis. If you see the way Rashi learns the pasuk is going to great lengths to emphasize the uniqueness of this event, that this was special, this is greater than everything else. And I can't, and up until now, no slave had escaped from there. It would seem to me from this that this was something that Yisrael viewed as being impossible, more or less. When you view something as being impossible, you're so overwhelmed by something, so you can't go any further. Even though intellectually you do believe in the existence of God, and you want to believe in it, but you're stuck with a problem. You couldn't get out of that problem. And Moshe Rabbeinu was aware of that. And his objective in telling him this information was to use it in such a way that it would break down the resistance. So that's why that would make sense. That when he came back to Yisrael to get permission to leave, and again I say, it wasn't an official shvuah. It meant that he agreed. He had taken on a responsibility to him. And he wouldn't just leave him in the lurch, because he was his rabbi. He was teaching him. And he was helping him to perfect himself. That was the Allah. In other words, he agreed that he had a certain responsibility for his perfection. That's why he had to go back to him. And in doing so, he gave a reason, he gave an explanation that would satisfy Yisro. I'm not leaving you in the lurch. Don't worry about it. I'm going down because I feel this responsibility to my brethren. Let me see what I can do. But that was much better, you see, to understate the thing, to let Yisro... So he brings the matter to Yisro's attention. I'm bringing it to his attention. I'm saying it's not impossible. I'm saying maybe something can be done. You've given up. In your mind, it's basically an impossibility. I'm saying it's not impossible. Let me see what I can do. Just keep an open mind about the subject. We'll get back to you on this. That's the best possible state to leave. He wanted to leave him in the best possible mental and emotional state, so that when, not to give it away, if you give it away, then it's no big deal. You see? I'm going to use a very rough analogy. Maybe it'll help. For example, if you didn't live through it, I keep repeating it. We lived through the time of the Six-Day War. And prior to that time, we weren't aware. Israel, of course, when you grew up with the idea of Israel being this fantastic and military, superpower, they could do anything they wanted. But that whole idea came to the world's attention after the Six-Day War. It was like a miraculous event. Before that time, when they were surrounded on three sides, and the Arabs threatened to wipe out, we were all in a state of tremendous fear, Jews throughout the world. I remember myself, I was in college at the time, but it was about a 2-week period from the time that the crisis began, and there was tremendous fear. No one had this confidence that now, after that time, let the Arab attack, they'll get wiped out. It was just the opposite. I mean, they surrounded on three sides. He had 100,000 troops in the Sinai. All the statistics in terms of tanks, airplanes, it looked like a holocaust. I mean, the Jews were really, really frightened. That's it. That's the end of Israel. Nobody knew how advanced the Israeli Air Force was. This was the first real opportunity they had to show it. And then when the war broke out, it was, I remember there was, at the time in the yeshivas, they had groups of guys learning throughout the day and the night to make sure that people were all constantly learning and everything was followed. It was like a real fear that something terrible would occur. And then what happened, then after the first day, it was unbelievable. That was like it was like a miracle. That's how people regarded it. It had a tremendous impact upon the whole Jewish community. It was like an unbelievable kind of thing. It was like a nace. Like the reports came in that the preemptive airstrike, and they won the war. The truth is, they won the war in the first hour. They knocked out the old three Arab air forces with the preemptive strike. And then the tanks going through Sinai without any air cover in the desert. If you don't have air cover against great tankers, I mean, you're going to get killed. They just won victory after the Golan and the Golan, and then in the Jordan and the conquering of Yerushalayim, every day was like an unbelievable thing. 6 days. It was an unbelievable impact. Now, it had a tremendous impact upon Jews. It was an emotional impact, and it brought people closer to their Jewishness and so on and so forth. Now, what was the ultimate effect? That's, of course, did it last, produce a lasting effect? Didn't. That's something else. It hadn't been exploited. I mean, because that's a question of how it was used. That was a great moment for somebody to come along. If there would have been an individual on the level of Mashiach, you see, that was a great opportunity to... Now that you're emotionally, everybody wants to be Jewish. Everybody wants to be Jewish. No one was ashamed of their Jewishness at that time. Now, if somebody could translate that into a real attachment to Torah, but just an emotional impact wears off. I mean, that's something else. But the impact was phenomenal. However, there were people that were not so affected. They weren't so moved emotionally. There were many, many people that understood that studied the strategies, the tactics, observed the Israeli Air Force in action. They couldn't predict it and all that, but they had a sense of it never was such a great miracle. See, the more you know, and the more you... Not that they knew for sure, that is, nobody knows for sure, but the more you know of the capabilities, the more information, so the less it's going to have that effect upon you. You see? Now, I'm not saying it's identical over here, but that's the analogy that I'm using. For example, I remember the commander of the Israeli, he was the real, one of the major heroes, was Mordechai Hod. He was the commander-in-chief of the Israeli Air Force. He was not the only one, but he was the commander at the time, worked out the whole strategy. And he had, by the way, because the Israeli cabinet themselves, they were much closer, they knew much more than we did. They met, they had plans for digging mass graves. I'm sorry, they didn't tell it at the time, because they expected tremendous casualties. It never occurred to them that no Arab plane would get through. They thought they'd be bombed. They were fighting a war for survival. He was among the most reassuring. He told them the plan. The basic plan, of course, was the sneak attack to wipe out the Arab air forces, and that's not an easy thing. But I mean, he was very confident, and he reassured them that we can do it. He had the plan, so I'm pretty sure that he was thrilled. No one is that confident, whatever. But the degree, you see, the impact of the miraculous, and it was miraculous. Because even with, we know, even with the best of plans, how many things could have gone wrong. I don't want you to think that it wasn't. I mean, I'm taking away from the actual miraculous. You see? Because even you could have the greatest plans and everything can go wrong. I mean, there was no guarantee. It wasn't guaranteed that they had to win. No, but the point of it is, though, that a person with resistance, see, the more he knows of the plan, the more resistance. There's room for the resistance to operate. And the less you know, and given our view of the situation, a tiny nation surrounded by these mighty powers and so on and so forth, and then we hear this tremendous victory, it has a different effect. So I'm using that as an analogy, that how a person receives the information, the state of mind, is extremely significant. And that is why, in my opinion, Moshe deliberately withheld the information about what the mission was, because it would have detracted from the ultimate emotional impact of hearing about the miracle and removing that last obstacle, which in fact it did remove the last obstacle.